Hi, my name is Lena Fersch and I have been in love with improvised theater for half my life. Lately, however, things haven't exactly been great. Improv and I were going through a rough patch and I need some outside help. I really want to get the spark back in the relationship. So I decided to talk to improvisers from around the globe to seek advice. How can I make up with improv? Let's find out. This week, my guest is Mark Jane, a British actor living in Paris. The first and the last time that I met Mark was at the Improv Festival 2019 in Würzburg, and we got to play in a show together. She's Dead, Now What? And that one was directed by Sarah Kinsella from Melbourne. We actually had a really good time. It was a super fun show. I still remember it fondly. And so I was excited that he agreed to come on the podcast and talk about life and improv and many more things. Mark is not only an actor, he is also a director and a teacher, all specialized in improvised theater. He founded a group called The Improfessionals a while ago. You might have heard of them. And he's also working with another group called O. All the links you can find in the bio. But now I'm going to stop talking about Mark and let him talk for himself. So have fun listening, everyone. And I was just wondering, have you ever felt that way or needed a break from
every
improvisation?
Every year.
Really?
Yeah. It's funny, people ask me, you love improvisation, you know, you must never get tired. I get tired all the time. I regularly have, I usually once a year, I have a crisis. And generally what happens is by the end of the year, September till July. Mm-hmm. So kind of like working year, let's say. By the end of July, I just don't want to hear about improvisation anymore. And I always make a point of going away on holiday for at least 6 weeks. And mm-hmm. when I go away for 6 weeks, I cut everything. I'll just choking here.
No, I don't want you to choke.
No, it's because I've been eating these biscuits. Here's a good thing for interviews. Don't eat Jammy Dodger biscuits before the interview. So, I usually have a break. And I make sure that for 6 weeks I cut off everything. I don't look at emails. I don't look at Facebook. I shut down everything. And I do not want to hear about improvisation for at least 6 weeks.
So is it a matter of being oversaturated?
Yes. I get to the point where I'm totally saturated with improv in terms of shows and teaching and everything. And mm-hmm. And having that break is really important. And mm-hmm. I don't think I could continue without it. If I don't have that break, I just get to the point where I really don't care anymore. And funny enough, well, with the lockdown and everything, obviously things have slowed down a lot. But actually, I found it quite refreshing because mm-hmm. things have slowed down. I've still had certain things because the way it works in France and the way the kind of stuff I do, I've still actually been managing to teach a little bit. And we had a period from summer till October where we played a bit as well, so it hasn't been complete nothing happening, but it has meant that things have slowed down, and I've actually found that quite refreshing. I've had time to actually sit back and actually think about things and develop maybe some ideas mm-hmm. and projects, because again, it's a matter of when you're full on all the time performing and teaching, you just don't have time to renew and refresh and recharge. And
definitely, and so it's like there's a saying in German, I don't know if that exists in French or in English, you can't see the forest because of all the trees.
Yeah, you can't see the forest because of the trees, exactly. Yeah, yeah, same expression, yeah. In French and in English, yeah, there you go. So it must be a good expression. But I regularly have crisis mm-hmm. and need to step back.
To the point where you go, I don't even know if I want to get back into it, or do you always find your way back?
I've had regular moments where I've been like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this. And before, I think I found my way back because I take a break, and then at the end of the day, this is my job, because it is my primary job. And so there's also the fact that it's your job and it's running all year round anyway, that you kind of get back into it anyway. But, mm-hmm. And there's also, to a certain extent, I find, which might sound terrible, but it's a job. And so at the end of the day, mm-hmm. it's a job like any other job. And so, you know, I think people think that because you're doing improvisation and because you're doing acting, then it must be just pleasure and wonderfulness and fantasticness all the time, and you're living your dream. And, you know, people often say to me, oh, you're so lucky, you know, your job is your dream. And I'm like, mm-hmm. yeah, but it's still a job, and there's still moments when I get fed up with it, and there's still moments when I get tired with it, and, you know, and so it's a job, yeah.
And it's funny that you're saying this, because just this morning I talked to a friend on the phone about how being an artist means going through a creative process that often isn't fun. That yeah. you know you have a goal and you know why you do it, but still it's work. And sometimes you will go around in circles and can't find the answer to a particular question. So yeah, that is work. And also in improvisation, I feel like most of us that do it professionally, they also have to take care of all the boring stuff, right?
Oh,
like
shit,
marketing
yeah.
and bookkeeping and all the things that, you know, are not fun.
Yeah,
and
because
not artistic.
Yeah, because you're basically your own freelance mm-hmm. company. I mean, you're your own personal company, so you have to do all the different things that a company would have to do, as you say, in terms of the finances, accounting, and mm-hmm. management, publicity, administration. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of work involved. That's not just getting off on stage and having fun.
So I'm wondering, when you say this is your job, do you ever feel like you don't really have a choice to walk away from it?
Yes, I have had that thought as well, because having spent so long doing improvisation professionally and having basically organized my entire life around that, I kind of think of myself, well, if I wasn't doing improvisation, what the hell would I do? I mean, I don't know how to do anything else, basically. There's also that. There's also this, okay, if I stop doing improvisation, what exactly am I going to do? I don't know, I've got no fucking idea. And
Is it just what the hell I'm going to do, or is it also who the hell am I?
That's an interesting one. It's not so much that, I don't think. I think I could find other things to do, but then, you know, there's also that question of, well, I've developed this to such a point that it's turning over really comfortably, and do I really want to start from scratch again on something else? And I have got other things that I'd kind of be interested maybe in doing, but I think I've just got to maybe an age and a point where I'm like, I don't know if I can actually start from scratch all over again. But there is that. And I think I'm not ashamed to say it, even though, yeah, I love improvisation and I'm passionate about it. And I've done all kinds of stuff about it. Yeah, I'm not ashamed to say that sometimes, yeah, I get fed up with it. Yeah.
Have you known that you wanted to be an actor from when you were young?
Yeah, yeah. It was very, very young. I think I was about 8 when I first said to my parents, okay, I want to be an actor.
And how did you come to that wish?
I have no idea.
Really?
I have no idea why I just suddenly decided that one day. I can't remember.
You must have seen theatre to get the idea, or
no,
movies?
No, movies, I think, more than anything as a kid. I think just, yeah, watching movies and television and stuff like that, I just thought always thought it looked fun. And I don't know why. I've got no idea. Funny thing was... no one else in my family is artist, actor, anything at all. Not at all. Completely opposite. Mm-hmm. And I found out that actually my great-great-grandmother, she actually wanted to be an actress. But she was in the southwest of England, in a little village in the southwest of England. You know, we're talking about late 1800s, early 1900s. And basically, her family said to her, no, you can't be an actress. Women don't do that. You're not allowed to do that. They have to stay here and help in the village. And so she was obliged to stay in the village. But she created a local theatre group. And
really? That's so cool.
And my grandmother actually gave me some of her... plays that she'd mm-hmm. been working on with her notes in, because she used to direct all the local shows and stuff like that. So there is someone in my family that did acting. So all I can think is I got it from her, even though I never met her.
But that's so cool, having that from your great... Did you say great...
Great-grandmother. Yeah, great-grandmother.
Great-grandmother, having those notes, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Yeah, it's pretty fun. One day I'm going to put on the show... with her notes.
You should.
Just to see what it's like.
many different shows that you develop.
Yeah.
One of which is Trio.
Yep.
You brought that show to the Improv Festival in Würzburg 2019. I got to watch it. It's or maybe you just tell us what it is.
It's a very simple idea. It's I take two audience members, so usually a man and a woman, and they come up on stage with me. The idea is that they're real audience members, so they're people who've never done theatre or improvisation before. And I ask them what kind of film genre they like or enjoy, and kind of discuss that with the audience. We select a film genre together, and then afterwards, well, for the rest of the show, for like 50 minutes or 55 minutes afterwards, we'll do a long form together. And so it's a long form in that genre, and they are both the heroes of the story. So they are improvising with me. They're actually performing. They're not just like sat at the side giving mm-hmm. ideas. They're actually performing. And they're the heroes of the story. And I play all the other characters in the story and the narrator. And we do a long form together for an hour.
So you have two jobs, basically. First off, you're taking care of two audience members
yeah.
that are probably super scared because they're standing on stage maybe for the first time. And at the same time, you're steering a story, or just you keeping in mind that a story has to be told. That just sounds like work. Is that work?
Well, yes and no. it all depends on, I suppose, what your background is and what you've trained in. I mean, yeah, it's work, obviously. Yeah, it is work. But it's a show that I created because it's the kind of things I like doing anyway. And so because it's the kind of things I like doing, it's stuff that I've worked on and trained in. And so once you've done something a lot, it's no longer work. It's just something you do. So it's a show that as I said, it's my fake solo show. It's based on things I enjoy doing. So I've always been passionate about storytelling and cinema and stuff like that. And then I always enjoyed audience participation games, mm-hmm. In short form stuff. So I just kind of like decided to put the two together.
And what has to happen for you to walk out of that show thinking, oh, I really nailed it?
Well, two things, and they're both things that you said. One, the most important for me, and afterwards I haven't got a total control over it because you never really know what's going to happen when you get people on stage. But the most mm-hmm. important for me is to hopefully see the two audience members have to have a wonderful time. So they have to have had a wonderful time. They have to have enjoyed the experience, and they have to go away beaming, feeling wonderful about themselves. That's mm-hmm. super important, especially at the end. Yeah, we give them an Oscar, and they win an Oscar. They have the whole audience applauding.
That's so sweet.
It's really important that they go away having had the best evening of their life. So that's important. On top of that, for the audience, I think it's really lovely if the audience can see the two, or at least one of the two, audience participants actually evolving during the show and mm-hmm. going and actually going beyond just, because they're all terrified at the start, as you said, they're terrified, they're shitting themselves at the start, both of them, mm-hmm. but if I can try and get them into some kind of comfort zone or some kind of situation where actually they start evolving and actually start improvising, and we can see that evolution during the show, that is very important as well. And the more I can get them to evolve, obviously, the better it is. And then the last thing also for the audience is I want to tell a good story. I want to make sure that there's a really solid, interesting, fun story there that the audience are going to really connect with as well.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, has there been a performance of Trio where that went horribly wrong? Where you couldn't make that happen?
And it's funny because that's the question everyone asks. the answer is no, but... no, it's always worked. I've never... I'm saying touching wood because it's the kind of curse of the show afterwards. It's never completely failed. There was one time when I had a guy that was really difficult. And it was early on when I started performing it. And it was an evening when I was doing some of the first shows in Paris. Lots of improvisers from Paris had come to see the show on that night. So I had an audience full of improvisers, which is not what I want because mm-hmm. I can't choose anyone. Yeah. Mm. I had a girl I could see that I was going to use, but I was looking for a guy and no one was there. And this guy turned up right at the last minute. And I said to the musician, I said, right, I'm going to pick him. I don't feel if it's going to work or not. I don't know. I'll pick him. We'll see what happens. So I made a mistake, picked him. And mm-hmm. Basically, yeah, he tried to destroy the show right from the start. So he, he was making comments to the audience all the time, you know, little asides, and basically saying to them, "Oh, look how stupid this guy is," you know. So he was really, really trying to destroy. Yeah, it's pretty, pretty major destroys to improv scene. Plus, he was doing everything. So I took him on in scene one straight away just to see what he was going to be like. And in scene one, he was literally the worst improviser in the universe. He was doing everything you should do to be an improviser's nightmare. You know, he was blocking everything, he was destroying everything, he was negating everything, he wasn't listening. It was a real roller coaster of fun. And so quite rapidly I then went on to scene two, made the girl more important in the story, so I knew that she was going to be essential, but then I couldn't ignore him, so I brought him back. And the funny thing was, the only way I could shut him up at the end of scene one was to have a house fall on him. So that made him shut up. And then in scene two, he started off, he was being interrogated by the police or something. And he just decided to break free of his chains. You know, he said, "Oh, look, I've broken my chains." But every time he did something, I accepted it totally. And I didn't get angry with him. I didn't tell him off. I just said yes to everything he did. And it was really powerful because, yeah, he broke the chains. And I was like, "Oh, my God, he's super strong." And what he'd forgotten was the genre of the story we were telling was superhero.
Ah, okay.
And then he decides he's going to escape from the prison. So he says, "I'm just going to walk through the wall." Well, I'm like, that's a wonderful gift in a superhero story. Mm-hmm. And so after about 15 minutes, where he tried basically to destroy everything in the story, he realized that every time he was destroying something, he was actually giving me a gift, and he was actually building the story. And so after 15 minutes he calmed down and it was fine.
That's so interesting that you're saying this, because I just wonder, why does somebody go up on stage and behave in a destructive way? Is it fear? Is there like a fear behind it to not be interesting, and if they feel like they're being seen in whatever they're offering, maybe it helps them to be not destructive or constructive.
Yeah, for me, the primary word is fear. I think a lot of what we might consider as destructive improvisation is just generated by fear of failure, and ego as well. Fear and ego are two pretty big problems, I'd say, that can lead to that kind of behavior. But I think fear is the big one, yeah. And afterwards, people react in different ways to that fear that might give them what we could consider as destructive behavior. But it taught me a huge lesson, and it's become something I now teach. I teach destroying scenes, because it's so interesting to see how it generates truly unexpected and spontaneous stories when people are getting up on stage and doing all the things that they shouldn't do. And it's very refreshing. And I think it's very good for improvisers as well to learn that all these problems about, you know, the rules of impro and blocking and all this, the problem's not the person making the mistake. The problem is how you react to that person.
Yeah.
And so often the reactions are quite negative or destructive in themselves, and that just creates even more of a problem. Whereas you can probably manage it. And if you manage it, you're probably going to discover all kinds of things that you'd never expected in your scene. And that's what we're supposed to be doing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's all a matter of expectations. And it makes me wonder, how much do we really want to improvise, right? Because those are the moments where we cannot rely on the rules or so-called rules. We can't rely on them. And that makes us improvise truly.
Yeah,
and
I guess it's more exciting.
Yeah.
That was the main one of the main reasons why I really got into Trio as well and developed the show, was because I love playing with audience members, because they're not improvisers. And they do such crazy things. Yeah, they make all the mistakes, and they do things that I would never imagine an improviser would do on stage. And it's so exciting for me to be on stage with someone like that, who you've got no idea what they're going to do.
But I guess you have to be very confident in yourself and in your skills to be able to do that. And also, you have to sort of have a very loving attitude towards whoever is on stage with you, right?
Yeah, yes, definitely. Self confidence is important. You've got to be coming at it from a strong standpoint. Yeah, and yes, as I said, the aim of the show is they have a wonderful time. So, you know, there's lots of discussions about, you know, inspire your partner, love your partner, and make them look good, all that kind of thing. And it's all this same issue of working in a benevolent way with someone else opposite you. But at the same time, yeah, my goal is that they have a wonderful time. And funnily enough, they give me a wonderful time, but by actually pissing about with me and making problems for me, and not necessarily trying to inspire me, but actually by screwing me up all the time. So it's also it's a mentality you got to, it's a spirit of play you got to have as well. You got to want to get yourself in difficulty. I think it's healthy to want to get into difficulty.
Just before, you said, when we were talking before the recording, you said you've been there for 25 years. That's a really long time.
It is a long time.
What made you leave the UK and go to Paris?
A woman.
A woman?
Yes. There you go. I'm still with her.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a love story.
Isn't that nuts? Yeah.
You crossed the Channel Tunnel for love.
Exactly. I fell in love with a French woman 25 years ago. And yeah, we met in England. Spent, I think, 6 weeks together, mm-hmm. and then I packed up everything, came to Paris, and I've been here ever since.
Did you say 6 weeks?
I think it was about 6 weeks. We met it's always a crazy story. It would make a great rom-com film. We met in York, in the north of England. She was there to learn English. She was on an English summer school, and I happened to be living in a building with her English teacher. And so one night her English teacher said to me, "Hey, do you want to go out and have beer with a whole pile of people who don't speak English?" And I said, "Oh, that sounds fun." So that's how we met. And so we spent the summer together, so 6 weeks. She came back to Paris, and 2 weeks later I arrived, and I've been here ever since.
In my life, I was at a point where I thought about moving to a different country permanently or for a longer time. And I realized I don't think I'm cut out for it. I'm too attached to my home, to my family. So I'm wondering, how was that for you when you arrived in Paris thinking, I'm going to live here now?
Well, to be honest, I was young. I don't think I thought about it a great deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it also happened at a time, it just kind of fell right. I mean, I'd already left university, all that kind of stuff, and I was working as an actor in England, and I'd just done a 6-month tour all around England and Scotland and Wales, performing all over the place for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And I literally had been all over England, Scotland and Wales. And at the end of it, I was really kind of like, I'd like to see somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so actually it kind of fell we met just after that, you see. So already at that point, I'd seen a lot of England and I was like, okay, or Britain. I was like, I kind of could do with seeing something else. And then I just really didn't think about it, which was a good thing. Cause I mean, let's face it, I couldn't speak French when I arrived here. I mean, it's a totally stupid thing to do. I had absolutely no career options. I couldn't speak I couldn't speak the local language. I had no idea what I was going to do. I just kind of said, oh, hell, let's go.
So what did you do when you arrived?
Well, I did the thing that everyone that's English that arrives in France does. I taught English.
Ah.
Because you don't need any qualifications. They say to you, are you English? You say yes. They say you're hired. So it's
perfect.
It's pretty easy. So for 8 months, I was teaching English to the businessmen in the business quarter of Paris. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And then through that, then after started discovering, the English theatre network here and what have you, and then started setting myself up doing theatre stuff. Initially, lots of corporate events, because again, Paris being a big international capital, lots of corporate events going on in English. To be honest, the thing that got me most jobs at the start was I was English.
That's super interesting.
Be
but then it sounds like there wasn't even a big necessity for you to learn the language, or was
there? Oh, yeah, there was. Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I learned that very quickly. Yeah, within the first 8-10 months, because you have to learn the language. I can't understand how people could go and live in a foreign country and not live the local language. I mean, you're not living in the same world. I mean, you got to learn the language.
So you just learned it by doing it?
Yeah. Oh, I'm lazy, see, so I can't be bothered to do classes or stuff like that. But I had the advantage of when I arrived here, I was living with my my girlfriend, who's French, and I had no English contacts. So basically, I was living in a French environment 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you got no choice. You learn.
And so she took an English language class back in the UK, right?
Yes, this is
so. But so you spoke to each other in English?
Well, so here's the thing. So she went to England to learn to learn English. So she spent 6 weeks there. She learned pretty quickly. And so when I arrived in France, yes, she could speak English. So initially you spoke English, but she couldn't speak great English.
Yeah.
And I couldn't speak any French. So
wow.
But she spoke enough to be able to understand and get by. But then quite rapidly, I started saying to her, well, you know, you're going to have to speak to me in French.
I think this is really interesting because, you know, I've had that situation, so I'm twice as interested with Spanish and English, basically.
Okay.
And it's hard to talk about stuff that matters in a language that isn't your first language. So my first language is German. Mm. I was speaking to my then boyfriend in English, who is Colombian. So so that was Spanish as well.
Yeah.
And I did, like, even though I think my English is, it's fine, I get by really well. But even in English, a language that I'm good at, I found it really hard to discuss things that matter. So I wonder, you're still together. How do you do it?
Yeah, well, initially, I agree with you. Initially, anything that was important, I would say in English. That's for sure. I definitely agree with you on that. Plus, I've had the thing that I've got a son who's now 15 that we had together. And so I made the choice straight away when he was born that I would only ever speak to him in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes back to what you're saying. It's because I felt that I wanted to be able to, I don't know, speak to him in my mother tongue. I just couldn't even conceive the idea of speaking to him in French. I was like, no, I want to be able to say what I feel in my language. Which
also, how lucky is he to you know, grow up bilingually?
Yeah, well, you should tell him. But then over the years, obviously, I mean, as I said, I've been here for 25 years now. So now I speak French all the time, basically. And so now, weirdly enough, in my brain, French has become the other main language that I have. And so I can now flick between French and English without really thinking about it. And so it now feels less important to maybe say important things in English. I'll do it in French or English. It doesn't. My brain's got to the point where, to be honest, I really don't know what I'm speaking anymore.
Do you remember the first time that you dreamed in French?
Yeah. I don't know. I know. If you ask me what I dreamt, I don't know. But I remember the morning waking up and thinking, oh, God, I dreamt in French. Yeah. And that's when you know that it's starting to sink in. Yeah. It's actually quite a positive thing. I was like, oh, this is a good sign. Yeah. So, yeah.
My sister is married to an Australian. And when I first met him 15 years ago, I was 15 years old. And that was before I had gone to the US for half a year to really study English.
Yeah.
So my English, it was always fun for me, but I wasn't really fluent in the language yet. But I had to talk to him in English. And my mom said that we were on a vacation, the whole family. And she said that at night, because we were sharing a room, I had explained the bus schedule to someone in English. So I was really happy then that it finally started to kick in. That was a good moment.
And with such an exciting topic as well.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, I'm a very organized person, so that makes complete sense that I would be dreaming about that.
That's quite scary that you're dreaming about bus schedules, Lena. I don't know what that says about your personality, but it's quite odd.
Maybe I'm just very boring underneath. Underneath it all, I'm just a very boring person.
No, of course not. But it's interesting.
Yeah, dreams are interesting anyway. Like sometimes I wake up in the morning and I go, why did that person show up in my dream? I haven't spoken to him in like 20 years.
Yeah, but you're lucky you remember it. I don't remember a lot of my dreams.
I think it's a matter of practice. I have a friend who keeps a dream journal. So every morning he wakes up, and he just takes notes on what he was dreaming, and so he's getting better at finding the words, because that's something I struggle with. I often remember my dream, and then I want to communicate it to someone, but it's impossible because I can't find the word to describe the thing that I was feeling in the dream.
Okay, that's a pretty crazy idea. Well, I'll try that. I'm just worried that it's going to be an empty blank page every day for the moment. But I've got to force myself to try and remember my dreams.
Can you steer your dreams while you're having them? Probably, you don't know because...
God, no. I can't remember what happened in them. I mean, I have a hard time remembering what happened 2 days ago, let alone in my dreams. But steering, controlling your dreams, that sounds like an insane thing to do, yeah.
I think that sounds really good. I can't do that. I cannot.
Okay.
Sometimes I know that I'm dreaming, which is good when I'm having a nightmare, but I cannot steer them. But, you know, some people, they can wake up in the middle of the night and then just decide to go back into the dream that they just had. And to me, that just sounds like an insane computer game sort of situation.
But now that has happened to me. I've had that experience of waking up, realizing you're in a dream, but then deciding to go back into it.
Really? That's
so cool.
And
the opposite one, waking up, realizing it's a nightmare, and thinking, okay, I won't go back into it.
That's really good. That's a good skill. I would like to have that.
Okay, well, I've got that skill, even if I can't remember what dream it was about.
Have been living in Paris for a long time.
Yeah.
So you're very Johnstone based, right?
Yeah, foundations are all Johnstone, yeah.
So you know theater sports, but I guess you've also come across Match a lot in France.
Oh, big time.
So for all non-improvisers who are listening to this podcast, mm-hmm. theater sports is a competition between two teams. So is Match, but they're very different. And I was just wondering, Mark, what's your experience with the two?
It's a weird thing because on paper, they both sound identical. Mm-hmm. And I remember when ITI, I don't think it's on their website anymore, but a long time ago when ITI redid their website, I seem to remember they put up a slogan or something saying, if you're doing a show where two teams are confronting each other around theatrical sketches, then you're playing theatre sports. And I remember thinking, well, they've just pissed off the whole of the French community there because the French have been doing it for years and it's not theatre sports. The Match and theatre sports seem the same, but there's a different spirit in them. There's a different logic. Structurally, they're different. I mean, the Match is already the weird thing with the Match is it takes place in an ice hockey rink.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, oh, here you go, yeah. So if you're doing it the traditional way, they actually, on stage, they have a little wall that they put around. They create a rectangle on stage with a little wall that they put around it, like a little ice rink wall.
Because interesting.
Because originally, the Match came from Canada, and originally it was a theatre group that used to do sketches during the intervals of ice hockey matches. And so all the decorum and the tradition of the impro match comes from playing in the intervals of ice hockey matches. And they actually created a whole pile of rules about how they could use this little wall as well. And so the traditional matches, when you go to see them in a theatre, they've got a little wall on stage. It's really weird. And it's like a little arena that they get into. Yeah. And it's only about like 50 centimetres high. But yeah, they step over it to go in and that's where they do their scenes.
So very sporty.
Well, this is the other thing with the Match is it's very... structured like a sport, very organized like a sport. There's a referee, and the referee has a whole list of penalties that he can whistle and blow up on and faults that you can do. There's an official list of impro faults that you can do that can be whistled by the referee. There's a whole penalty system. If you get 3 faults in a show, then you're expelled from the show and all this kind of stuff. So it's very much structured like a sport. And to the extent that it's developed leagues, and there are leagues all over France, and teams and league matches and international league matches. It really is structured like sport, much more so than theatre sports. Weirdly enough, even though the word sport is in theatre sports, where theatre sports, you have the judges and what have you, and obviously there's the scores and everything like that. But there's a lot of it which is just there for the fun decorum, but at the end of the day, doesn't count. Now, the thing in the Match is, the problem often with the Match, which is the same problem which happens in theatre sports, is the sporting logic and the competition takes over. And I think the match maybe has had that problem more because there is much more decorum in it that really resembles a sporting match. Mm-hmm. This kind of spirit of competitive sporting maybe is taken over a little bit sometimes, and maybe it's sometimes lost its kind of theatrical colour. But it's the same kind of problems that theatre sports has had as well. I mean, I'm not saying one's necessarily better than the other. They just have different attacks on it. The power of the match is that it spread improvisation all over the French-speaking world incredibly efficiently and in a very structured and organised way, which means that today the French-speaking world, and you know, I'm talking about France, Canada, Switzerland, Belgium, you know, the French-speaking countries like that, but definitely France and Canada, have got thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of improvisers because since the 1980s, the match and the leagues and the structure was instantly installed everywhere because it was so easy to understand and accessible because it was a sporting structure. And so it has meant that the improvisation network in the French-speaking world developed hugely.
Interesting. I feel like match, other than theatre sports, is used for all kinds of competition and improvisation. Because in Germany, we also do match, but it's very different. It's not, we don't have the ice rink. And it's not with, you know, we don't have necessarily have referees. Sometimes I think they come up, but then it's like funny characters. It's not really a referee in a sporty sort of sense.
Yeah.
And I always found it to bit a bit. I had fun doing that when I first improvised, and then I sort of felt that it wasn't so inspired because it wasn't really about what the performers were inspired by, but what a host of the show decided. This is what you're going to do. So this is what I like about theater sports, is that you're trying to figure out what would the other team really enjoy playing? What do we really enjoy playing? And then just having the challenge system.
Yeah, I quite agree. I mean, that's one of the big technical differences between the two. As you say, in the matches, it's the referee that's deciding everything. And theater sports, the fact that the teams are throwing the challenges to each other completely changes the dynamic between the teams. And as you said, the idea of playing together, whereas because in the match there's a referee who's deciding everything, it splits the teams up much more, and it generates even more of this kind of competitive thing because it's really us against them instead of us deciding how we want to play with them, which is not the same thing.
I think theater sports really is quite a difficult format.
Yes.
To perform, because other than in Maestro, which is also a Johnstone format, where, like, just for everybody who doesn't know this, 10 to 14 performers compete against each other, and there's directors setting up the scenes, basically. And so in theater sports, it's a system where all the different roles have a very specific task, I guess. And you're much more responsible as a performer, as a host, as a judge. There's a lot more responsibility, and when all those roles come together, it can be really, really awesome. I've seen some great shows.
Yeah,
it's hard.
Yeah, but it is really hard. I mean, I think, if you don't, all those elements don't come together, it can be an average kind of show. But every now and then, if you're lucky and you really get all the people that really have understood and really meld together in all the different roles, then it could be fantastic. But as you said, there are a lot of roles to take care of and a lot of things to be thinking about in each different person's integration into the show, which make it actually quite a complex show to manage. And it's a short-form cabaret, basically, with a kind of decorum around it. And short-form's hard. I mean, I think short-form's hard. I think, you know, people knock short-form. They say, I much prefer long form. It's much more interesting. Do a good short form show. It's damn hard to do a really good, hot short form show where, you know, there's lots of great stuff. Okay, you're going to screw up a few scenes, and that's fine. That's normal. But to have an overall really good, strong short form show that's varied and rich, damn hard.
Are you up to play a little game with me?
Yes, for the end of always.
This? Yes. Perfect. All right. So actually, in the pre-conversation before this podcast, I learned from Mark that the game we're going to play is called Call My Bluff. And you said a TV show in the UK?
An old TV show that ran for many, many years in the UK, yeah.
Mark and I will each say a sentence that's true about ourselves, something from our lives, and the other person has to find out if it's true or false, basically. They can investigate. And it's going to be three rounds. So this is Call Your Bluff. Call My Bluff.
Call My Bluff or Call Your Bluff. Let's call everyone's bluff.
Call Everyone's Bluff. That's my version of it. Also, I don't get copyright issues if I just call it Call Everybody's Bluff.
They're not airing anymore. I think you're okay.
Whew, okay, perfect. So, Mark, do you want to, as a guest, do you want to start with the first sentence?
Okay, so I got to say something about me, Okay.
That could be true or false.
That could be true or false. Okay. Okay, here's one. I met with Prince Charles. Is that enough for you? Do you want more?
That is enough. You seemed like you'd be saying more, and I was like, where? When?
Where was back in Dorset, where I was born, and when I was 16.
You were 16. So what was the occasion?
Now, what you have to know is that...
Are you stalling?
No, not at all. Prince Charles owns huge amounts of land in England, as all the royal family do. Most of the land around where I lived when I was a kid was owned by Prince Charles. And Prince Charles decided one day that he wanted, because he's always been interested in, ecology and stuff like that. And at the time, he was very up on that. He decided he wanted to build a town, which would be his dream town, ecologically wonderful, perfect dream town. And so the town where I lived, which was Dorchester, there's a huge, huge area of land on the side of it, which is owned by him. And so he said he was going to build a new town connected to Dorchester. And he was going to build it with his vision of what a town would be like. And so he asked the local people what kind of ideas they had, because he pretty much was obliged to ask them. He couldn't just go and build a town, and so because I was at the school at the time, some of the kids from our school were chosen to go and present the kids' ideas on what they wanted for a town, and I was chosen to go and present these ideas.
So you actually met him and talked to him?
I met him, I talked to him, I shook his hand.
You shook his hand.
Yeah.
So you said he's an ecologically interested man.
Yes.
And you knew this before.
Well, it was at the time when he started getting into this and started talking about it.
All right. I'm going to say that this one is true.
Do I tell you now or do I come back next
week? No. Tell me.
It's true.
It's true.
Yeah.
You had that. Yeah, I could tell it from looking in your eyes.
Okay,
that
damn.
Was not a lie.
Okay, I'm going to try and lie better.
Haha.
Okay.
So, ready for mine?
Okay, go.
I got my belly button pierced when I was 14 years old.
Okay. And so, what was the incentive for this?
Well, everyone had one.
That's a pretty weak incentive.
Well, but the thing is, when you're 14, that is a big incentive. And
that's showing lack of self-discipline there, Lena.
I guess you're right.
Okay, so everyone had, you mean friends?
Yes, I was part of a group of girls and all of them had one except for one. And I have to say, I still have it today.
Okay.
So maybe it wasn't just that everybody had one. Maybe I just really wanted to have it. Now it feels like it's part of my body. I tried to put it out like two or three times and I couldn't because I'd really miss it. It's strange, but I'd really miss it.
So the question is, who did it? Did you get it done professionally or did you get it done cheap or how did you get it done?
No, I got it done professionally. I would have never considered. I'm the type of girl that dreams about, a bus schedule.
Yes,
so I would never just do that on my own.
My next question is, did you tell your parents?
They had to consent to it. I wasn't allowed to go. The studio wouldn't have done it unless I brought one of my parents.
Okay, well, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, but I was really surprised that they said yes, because that's really unlike my parents to allow something like this.
Okay.
And I asked them thinking, oh, you know, I'll just try, but they're going to say no anyway. And when they said yes, I thought, well, now I can't back out of this, because this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. And so I got it done like a little pink stone. I don't have that anymore, but originally it was a pink stone that I got.
Okay. And you still have you don't have the pink stone anymore. It's something different now.
I still have it, but I don't wear it.
Okay. Yep. And so my next question is, when you did you go and show all your friends, and were they impressed?
I did show my friends. I don't think that they were impressed, because it was just something that you do, that you did, obviously. Like, at the time, it was like, oh, yeah, she got it too. Okay, great.
Okay, so did it make you feel better about yourself?
I guess, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I felt more like a grown-up, because that was a big thing.
Okay, so yeah. It worked.
Yeah.
Okay.
It worked.
Okay, so I have to guess if this is true?
Yep.
I'm saying yes.
And that is correct.
Yeah, okay.
Was a true thing.
Yeah. Okay. But interesting, your parents. Interesting, I don't know how the conversation went, but the moment where you say to your parents, Mum, Dad, you're going to have to come with me to get my belly button pierced, because I can't do it without your consent. That must have been an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I don't remember that, actually. Okay. I just remember being really surprised that I got the go to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I asked you if you did it officially or not, because I'm like, yeah. Well, that age. Okay.
No, it was...
Great parents.
Surprised. Yep, they're good. I've got good parents.
Well done, you can keep them.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Mark, next round. Okay. So we both got we each got 1 point.
Okay.
So the next round is for you to start.
Okay, I got one.
Perfect.
All right, you ready?
Yep.
Okay. I had a private concert with Rod Stewart.
How private?
As in, I was the only person in the room with him.
Okay, so now you're going to have to convince me that that is true, because I'm not buying it. So, in which year was this?
This was in 99, must have been 99, something like that. 98, 99, something like
so
that.
So you were how old?
25-ish, yeah, must have been 25. I'm trying to calculate myself. Yeah, 24, 25, something like that, yeah.
Okay, so Rod Stewart. So who set this up? How did this happen?
Well, it was an accident, because, who would set that up? I mean, yeah, it sounds like an insane thing to set up. Because at the time, I was working in corporate events,
yeah? Mm-hmm.
And I did a corporate event in the casino at Deauville. So the casino at Deauville is a very big, famous casino in the north of France, very mm-hmm. posh and very well known. All the posh Parisians go there and what have you. Anyhow. And we were doing a corporate event there over the summer. So throughout the summer, our troupe was there and we were in there in residence. And basically every day we go around in costumes doing 1920s dances in the casino, because it was the 50th anniversary of the casino, so they were celebrating their 50 years. And so we were doing little dance routines and sketches and stuff like that every day in the casino for weeks. Mm-hmm. That was our gig. In the casino, there's a theatre, because the casino is a casino, but it's also got a restaurant and it's got a little theatre as well. And so they have artists that come through and play in the theatre to also entertain all the locals, what have you. And at that time, Rod Stewart had signed up to do a 3-week run in the casino of Deauville,
mm-hmm.
in the theatre. And, our troupe was there all the time. Yeah, we were there all the time, all day. We lived in the casino, basically. We were just there roaming around the place. They gave us free roam of the whole place. And one day, it just so happened, one of the casino guys said to me, oh, if you're interested, Rod Stewart's doing his sound check in the theatre. And so I went into the theatre's, yeah, it's all in dark. Rod Stewart basically is on stage, yeah, sound checking with a piano and just basically singing his songs on his own, just for the sound check, his own personal sound check. The theatre's in the black, it's all dark. So I crept in at the back of the theatre. He didn't even know I was there. So it was a private concert. But, and I just sat down and listened to him for an hour.
Okay, so, well, now I'm not so sure. Maybe you're not lying after all, because because it wasn't really a private concert. I thought he came to your living room and he was like, so here's my, you know, I brought my keyboard, let's go.
If private means me and Rod Stewart, it was private.
It was private. Okay, I'll let you have that. It was private, but not intentional.
No, and he didn't know I was there.
And he didn't know. Oh, it's real. It's a hard one. It's a really hard one, Mark. But I'm going to say it's just too absurd that you met Prince Charles and then the next story you're telling me is that you got this concert by Rod Stewart. I'm not buying it, but I think that the casino does exist.
Okay, so you're saying it's false?
Yep.
Ah, damn you, Lena.
Is it false?
It was false, but it was false, but the story about the casino is true, and the private concert is true.
Oh,
but it wasn't with Rod Stewart. It was with a French singer called William Scheller.
Okay.
So I changed the name of the guy.
You changed the name of the guy. And because if it wasn't a true story, no, sorry, if it was a false story, you'd be a really good liar, because I'm also seeing your face and you didn't show any sign of lying. But then it was just the mix up of the name. Very, very smart move, Jane. Well, smart move.
The best lies are based on the truth.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So, okay, let's see. What am I going to go with?
You got me.
I did get you. Yes. Okay, let's go with this one. I only got the chicken pox when I was 23 years old.
You only got the chicken pox when you were 23 years old?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, so you never got it when you were a kid?
No, I didn't.
Have you got any brothers and sisters? I can't remember.
I do. Three. I'm the youngest.
Oh, okay. Did they all have chicken pox as kids?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they did all have the chicken pox. Yeah.
But because you were the youngest, they'd had it before you came along anyway.
Yeah, because I'm 5 years behind the last one, so I'd figure that my sister had it before I was born, yeah.
Okay. And at school, when you were a kid, friends never had chicken pox?
No, not that I can recall.
Okay, so you come from some rare part of the world where chicken pox doesn't exist.
Well, in my world, it didn't. We all live in our bubble, right?
Okay. So you managed to get through the whole of your childhood without chicken pox.
Yep.
And then you got it when you were 23, you said? Do you know who you got it from?
I have no idea. It doesn't make any sense that I got them. And it was the worst timing or the best timing.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, because it was 3 weeks before we opened the theater sports conference in Würzburg. So that was a huge event. And I had been looking forward to it for a year. And I got it 3 weeks before. And my doctor... he's not a very sensitive person, very old school, very rough.
Okay.
And he was, you know, telling me about all these horrible scenarios that could happen. He told me about all those horrible scenarios that could happen. And I just thought, I just have to get through this and I need to be okay. And I was okay in time, in time.
Okay. So how bad did you have it?
Bad?
Okay.
Bad.
Because everyone says it's worse when you're adult.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was even lucky because it was just 3 weeks, but it was insane. Like, I had them all over my head.
Oh.
So this is going to be a little bit disgusting. I'm sorry for everyone listening.
But go for it. Give us the gory details.
No, it was horrible because it was on my head and I couldn't wash my hair for those 3 weeks, which probably was good for my hair because they say you wash it too much anyway. But it really didn't feel great. But I couldn't have any shampoo on it. So that was... That was pretty rough. Yeah.
That's evil.
Yeah, it was not very nice.
Have you any scars left over? Because sometimes with chicken pox, that leaves scars.
I do. I have one on my, like a tiny one on my forehead. But I like having it because my oldest sister, she has one in a very similar spot, like between her eyebrows. So we now share that. So it's nice. Yeah.
You have a common forehead scar.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Yeah. And when you had it, you didn't give it to anyone else?
I don't know.
Okay,
I
mean, okay.
I'm hoping okay. I didn't give it to anybody else. Okay. I don't know when I was contagious, but well, my parents both had them when they were kids, so I was able to stay with them. So I basically went into isolation with the two of them, and that was okay.
Okay. Well, I reckon that's true.
Are you sure? I'm 100% sure that this is true.
Don't play that game with me. That's psychological screwing with me.
I know. It's part of the game.
I'd say it's true. I think you did have it when you were 23.
And that, Mark, is correct. Ooh. I did have them when I was 23. So okay, two points each. Two points each.
So it's all going to be on the last round.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right. Do you have something?
Yeah, I think I've got one.
Perfect.
Okay. So, okay, desperately trying to get that last point in. So where I come from in the southwest of England, Dorset, is a region known for its, fossil finding. There's lots of fossils. Oh. The coast is even called the Jurassic Coast. Because, it sounds very sexy, but it's not. because basically along the whole of the south coast, there's all kinds of beaches and cliffs where literally fossils are just falling off the cliffs all the time. There's even one beach which is so well known for fossils. You can just walk along it, bend down, pick up a fossil. You know, it's really insane. Yeah, so we've got ridiculous amounts of fossils and dinosaur remains all over the place. And one day I found a bone from a Diplodocus.
Is that a dinosaur?
Yes, it is. It's not called a Diplodocus anymore. At the time, it was called a Diplodocus. Nowadays, I think they call it a Brachiosaurus or something like that. They've decided that Diplodocus doesn't exist anymore. But at the time, we called it a Diplodocus.
How do you even know that it was a
Diplodocus.
Diplodocus.
I like you pronouncing this. I'm glad I came up with the fact that we could use the word Diplodocus. So how did I know it was Diplodocus bone? Because there in the town where I live, Dorchester, there's a museum, the Dorchester County Museum, and in there they have a whole part of the museum that's dedicated to fossils and dinosaurs. Because the area is so full of fossils and dinosaur remains and stuff like that, they have a permanent team there. And basically what you can do is if you find anything, you can literally take it into them and they will look at it and then they'll tell you if it's interesting or not.
And what's that place called?
The Dorchester County Museum.
Okay.
In the town of Dorchester. Mm-hmm. And it's a very tiny little museum. But it's because Dorchester's a tiny little town, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But they have got a big dinosaur thing there. And there's also since a second museum that's opened up in Dorchester called the Dinosaur Museum. And it's literally, I don't know how I could explain it to you, it must be about, I don't know, 50 square meters. It's a tiny little thing because it's such a tiny town. But there's now actually a specific dinosaur museum. But at the time, then, the dinosaur museum didn't exist. There was the Dorset County Museum. And that's where you go to analyze stuff.
Okay. So how long did it take for them to analyze this?
Oh, not long. We took it in the morning because I was only 13 at the time. So we took it in the morning with my parents. And by the afternoon, they'd already phoned us to say what they thought it was and if it was something interesting or not. Because what they look at is they know just by looking at it if it's going to be something that's could actually be a fossil or not. And they mm-hmm. very rapidly can identify if it's a fossil that could be just any old animal or it could be something more interesting. So, but by the afternoon they phoned us to say that, yes, it was probably a dinosaur bone. But then they had to keep it on for another week to actually confirm dates and what creature and all this kind of stuff.
So, Mark, here is what I think is happening. You saw my face and I looked very skeptical when you said that it only took a few hours to identify the dinosaur. And then you made up that whole story about them taking another week to confirm it. So I'm calling bullshit. You have been lying to me. Also because, tell me again, what was the name of the dinosaur?
A Diplodocus.
A Diplodocus. See, I think you made up that name. No, I think you almost said that before. No. I think, I don't have to look it up online. I'm positive that you're lying to
me. Okay, well, here's the truth. Do you want to know the truth of if this is true or not? Well, actually, it's false. Yeah, you're right.
Did you make up the entire thing?
No, but a well, yes and no. Diplodocus does exist. You should look that up. You should look that up. Even though I do believe that they don't use that name anymore because they've now decided it's part of another species or something like that. And the Jurassic Coast is true, and where I come from is known for fossils. But I never actually found one that interesting.
Okay. All right. But, you know, if you get it right now with me, we both end up winners.
I know. Huge pressure.
Yeah, I know. So let's see.
Okay.
If you can call my bluff. Okay. So my last one is, I trashed my dad's car the day after I got my license.
It's a good one. I think lots of people have done that.
I hope so.
So what was the car? Can you remember what car it was?
Yeah, my it was a BMW.
Okay.
My dad always had a BMW. Okay. Yeah, so it was one of those.
And so how did you trash it?
Well, I was really proud of myself because I had gotten into the car and I had gotten through Stadtverkehr, like the city traffic in Würzburg, because I was going to go and see a friend. And I was so proud of myself because everything had worked smoothly. My heart was, you know, beating very fast. And I parked the car in front of my friend's house, and she got in, and we were going to go to another friend's place. So I picked her up. We drove to that other place, and just when I was about to park, I had already, like, it was fine in the space that I was in. But I thought I can do better because I was getting cocky. Okay. And then I didn't, because this was a car that didn't have the beeper yet, right? Like nowadays, this probably wouldn't happen, but it didn't have that. And I got cocky. And so I went into a lamp post.
Okay.
But not just a little bit, but like, because I just didn't see it. I thought, no, that's fine. I can just go back and, you know, back out a little bit and then get back in. But no, like not even a little bit. Like the light at the back end,
completely
trashed. Okay. So I mean, the car wasn't trashed, but I was really embarrassed.
You destroyed the lights and the rear bumper, basically.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So how did your dad react? That's what I want to know.
Well,
was
he
as
not
nice with you about that as he was with the belly button, piercing?
No, he was really, really not amused. He, like, I remember him taking this big sigh, and I thought, oh my god, now it's going to come. He was like, no, it was horrible. But I was devastated on the phone. Like I was sitting there with my friend who comforted me in the car, and I was crying, and I was like,
you phoned him straight away.
Yeah, I did. I phoned him straight away to tell him.
Yeah,
I felt so guilty. I phoned him right away, but because I was so devastated, he was, I think he had to sort of be the nice guy. He couldn't feed into my self-loathing at that point.
Yeah, especially it was actually probably quite an interesting strategy to phone him and not have him face to face with you.
I didn't even consider that, to be honest. I didn't even consider it because I felt so guilty. And also, what you have to understand is I am the youngest of four kids.
Ah, yes.
So I always felt like I needed to prove that I'm also a grown-up. And I was 18 years old. And I thought, well, now I've had my driver's license. I'm going to go study next year. I'm a grown-up as well. So for my identity at that point as a grown-up, it was horrible because I trashed my dad's car. And I'm clearly not a responsible person. At least that's what I thought back then.
Did any of your other brothers and sisters trash cars?
I think so. I remember that. I think when my sister went out of our driveway, I think one time she went into the fence, the garden fence.
So your dad,
just a little bit.
So your dad might be getting used to it by now.
Well, yeah, yeah. He's used to a lot of trouble with four kids. I mean, you know, things happen all the time. So
afterwards, did he let you drive the car again?
Yes, he did.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, of course. Because basically it was like you need to drive it again so you don't get scared of doing it.
Okay.
So I think that was a good idea.
We've proved today that you have great parents.
Yeah, I think so. I do have great parents.
Okay, so, you know, I wanted to believe this. I wanted to say it's true. I'm wanting to say that it's a true story. That's what I'm saying.
And it's incorrect.
Oh, no.
I win this game.
You're too good. You're too good. I couldn't see. That was very good. What convinced me was when you said you phoned him. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, so you phoned him? And you just were like, yeah, that convinced me. I was like, oh, that's true. Okay, you're too good. I couldn't beat you.
You tried, Mark. You tried your best.
I tried. I couldn't.
Ah, that was fun. Thank you for playing along. You're the runner-up. I mean, you know, that's great.
Oh, thank you. Oh, well, I feel so much better.
That was really fun. Thank you so much for playing with me. And also, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and just talking about taking breaks from improv and all the other things that we got to. It was really fun. Thank you.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Thanks very much, Lena. It was a pleasure.
So I hope I'll get to talk to you in person soon. That would be nice.
Yes. God knows when, but it's going to happen pretty soon.
I hope so.
Yeah, it will.
Hey guys, thanks so much for listening. If you want to hear more from Mark, he is actually bringing out a book soon. He wrote one in French a while back, and now there's going to be a translation of it. The book is called Games and Stakes, The Improvised Theater Toolbox. So if you're looking for some new insight, make sure to check out his website on when exactly the book is coming out. Also, there's one more thing. This podcast is produced by the Association of the Würzburger Improtheater Festival. Many of you might know our main annual event that usually happens at the end of October. This year, however, it's going to happen in July, so make sure to check out our website for more info. But we also organize various other projects throughout the entire year. For instance, this podcast. If you'd like to support our work, you can help us with a donation. You can donate via PayPal. That's paypal.me/improvfestival or directly to our bank account. For more info, visit the link in the description. Thank you so much and have a great day wherever you are on this planet.